Some schools use seclusion rooms or restraint to address serious behavior challenges, but is there enough oversight of the practices, and are school employees properly trained in these approaches? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the use of school seclusion and restraint and whether federal cuts could make oversight more difficult are Disability Rights Ohio Senior Attorney Kristen Hildebrand. Welcome to the program, Kristen.
Thank you, Lucy. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. And two parents whose children have experienced these practices, Mary Kate Pembroke and Ryan Dunkel. Thank you for being here, Mary Kate and Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Lucy.
Kristen, define what we mean by seclusion rooms and restraint. What does this look like in schools?
Seclusion rooms are typically small padded rooms that are in the school building somewhere that are used to put children in who are having some kind of behavior event in the school setting. They have doors on them that typically have glass windows in them, so a school staff can observe what's happening in that seclusion room. And restraint can look like a variety of different things. What we typically see in schools is physical restraint, where one or more adults, or sometimes a school resource officer, puts their hands on a child to move that child to a different location, or hold them down, or keep them from moving to a location that the school doesn't want them to go to. So it's typically an adult holding that child, but we also sometimes encounter restraints that are mechanical, where a student might be somehow held down in a chair. We have seen, unfortunately, circumstances where kids have been taped to wheelchairs or taped to school chairs, that kind of a restraint.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about school seclusion rooms and restraint to manage students' behaviors. Do you have experience with this as an educator or as a parent? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Kristen, which students are most likely to be subject to being put in these seclusion rooms or being the subject of restraint?
Yeah, these two techniques are disproportionately used against students with disabilities, particularly students who have a behavioral component as part of their disability. So we commonly see it in our practice in children who are on the autism spectrum, and also children who have mental health issues that are impacting their behaviors in the educational setting.
Mary Kate, tell us about your son and what he experienced in elementary school.
When my son was in kindergarten, he was subjected to restraint and seclusion on a regular basis. There were times where, so he wouldn't sit in a chair correctly one day, and the matter was escalated and he was restrained and put in a seclusion room for over a half an hour. There's another day he wouldn't sit on the carpet for morning meeting. And that ended up being 3.5 hours of exclusion from the classroom. But what was most common was he was labeled defiant a lot of the time because teachers would ask him to read, and he would say, I can't. And they took that as I won't. It turned out he was dyslexic and he hadn't figured out how to crack that code yet. The seclusion room was just really anywhere that the school could find space. There was a storage room in the basement. This is a century-old school. There were no windows. There was a crack in the tile floor. And he would tell me that he would stare at the crack in the floor and imagine about tunneling out. Mm.
And you mentioned your son is dyslexic. Does he have other disabilities?
He does. When what we noticed first was actually the problems that he had writing. And he is he's diagnosed with a specific learning disability in written expression. And it's similar to dysgraphia. He's also has ADHD and diagnosed with general anxiety disorder.
Ryan, tell us about your son. I understand he's mostly nonverbal.
Yes, my son is partially verbal. I have a 9-year-old child. He is on the autism spectrum, and he has significant support needs. What happened to us is that we moved from a district where he was getting the needs that he really needed, and we moved to a different school district, and there was a immediate evidence that there was a large disparity in how his care was being handled. And with that, we are now dealing with an issue filing 2 complaints against the state currently, with the state currently against the school district due to the restraint and seclusion and them not reporting to us. We have only in the last 2 years have had 3 notices of restraint, even though we have had multiple communications with them on a regular basis of him being restrained, of extended periods of dysregulation. We had one incident where it was 3.5 hours of dysregulation and without a single phone call to their parents. And so we are currently trying to advocate for him.
Yeah. And Ryan, what is the school's explanation for the actions they've taken?
What happened, when we escalated our concerns for his safety, we then saw a harsh pushback from the school where our communications were pretty much cut off. We were getting regular behavioral updates from the school through a messaging app that we had with them. And those fell off the day after we complained about his safety concerns, because our son now is self-injuring on a regular basis. Over time, we've seen this heartbreaking shift where self-harming behaviors, aggressive outbursts, and emotional shutdowns were happening on a regular basis and still are. Even last week, he got escorted to meet me at the lobby, and he had 3 teachers coercing him down the hallway along with a student resource officer. And again, he's a 9-year-old. So it was very upsetting to witness, unfortunately. And then also seclusion is a huge part of what he's going through. He's not in a padded seclusion room, but he is often separated into a separate room due to his emotional outbursts and his desire to not want to be there, unfortunately.
Oh. Goodness. Well, we do have a caller on the line that we're going to hear from. Excuse me. Travis, thank you so much for your call. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think it's important to understand. I've been a school administrator in the past, and that restraint is really just a very last resort. Most people who are trained in doing the restraints are told you only do this if there is an imminent threat to the child or another person. And therefore, you don't want to go through with it unless it's just absolutely 100% necessary.
Thank you for that comment, Travis. Did you, when you were a school administrator, were there students in your school who experienced restraint repeatedly, or was it a very rare circumstance?
It was very rare. And as an administrator, you're always putting yourself into harm's way when you do that, because the times where I had to restrain a child, I think maybe 2 or 3 times. One time I ended up with a concussion. And just the amount of paperwork and just safeguards that there are in place really make you not want to have to do a restraint. And it's really set up to protect the child in almost every instance.
Well, I appreciate that perspective, Travis. Thank you so much for calling. Kristen, Travis just said that, you know, this is designed to be a last resort. Are there state and federal policies or laws concerning when seclusion rooms and restraint can be used?
Yes, Ohio has a rule specific to the use of restraint and seclusion in school settings. The first iteration of that rule was in 2013, and then it was later amended in 2021 to add a process whereby parents could file a complaint, similar to what Ryan was talking about. That rule, as Travis said, says that school districts should only use these techniques, restraint and seclusion, if there's an immediate risk of physical harm to the student or others, and there's no other effective method of intervention that is available. And so he's correct. In best practice, that's what's supposed to happen. But as Mary Kate and Ryan have said, their children have been restrained in situations where I don't believe it meets that standard. So when Mary Kate was talking about her child refusing to sit in a circle on the ground or not agreeing to read, those certainly aren't situations that rise to the level of an immediate risk of physical harm. And the work that I do at Disability Rights Ohio every day tells me that school districts, there's a lot of diversity in how well a school district is resourced to avoid using these very harmful techniques. So perhaps Travis is in a district that understands this rule very well and has enough resources to provide positive behavioral interventions to children. But a lot of school districts in Ohio don't have the resources or the understanding of the law or how detrimental these techniques can be for children to really avoid them, like Travis's district.
Again, we're talking about school seclusion rooms and restraint to manage student behavior. Do you have experience with this? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Kristen, one of the points Travis raised also was that this was very rare in his experience as an administrator. But how often are students being restrained or being placed in seclusion rooms? How rare is it in Ohio?
Well, the problem with answering that question is we don't have good data that we can rely on to know that number. The Department of Education and Workforce does collect annual data from school districts on the use of restraint and seclusion, but the data are only as good as what the school districts are reporting. And as Ryan mentioned, often parents aren't provided notice that these techniques are being used on their children, even though our state law requires school districts to provide parents with immediate and no later than 24-hour notice. So we have a system where the data are not accurate, in my opinion, based on the self-reporting from the school districts and the fact that parents aren't made aware that these techniques are being used. Anecdotally, I know from the work that I do that it's happening on a regular basis, particularly with the students I told you about before who have, you know, who are on the spectrum or who have some kind of behavioral component to their disability. These techniques are being used on a routine basis, even though there isn't an immediate risk of physical harm as required by the rules. So can't give you a definite answer, but I know anecdotally it definitely is happening throughout Ohio.
Kristen, is this more common with students of color also? I've seen national reporting on that.
Yes, probably. We have really good data that the use of disciplinary techniques like suspension and expulsion are used overly for students of color. And I think the same is true because, you know, that these kinds of techniques are used in the course of other disciplinary procedures that happen in school. And so it's not unusual for a student to misbehave in school and for restraint or seclusion to be a part of the disciplinary techniques that the school is using.
If I could, I wanted to say my child is a person of color, and we keep trying to tell ourselves that's not what's happening. Mm-hmm. But It is a concern for us, very much so. He's the only one of the only ones in the school district for him as well.
Yeah, it must be hard to not think about that when you're dealing with this, Ryan. Mary Kate, you know, Ryan was talking about how he and his son's mother have not been informed every time his son has been subjected to these practices. Mary Kate, do you feel like the school informed you every time they used these practices on your son?
Absolutely not. At the very beginning, we had a kind of a behavior sheet that would come home every day. And so I would have tally marks of all the times that there was a verbal outburst or something along those lines. And so at that time, restraints and seclusions were calculated down to the minute. But that really wore on me as a parent. And eventually we stopped that kind of practice. When he moved up into middle school, we experienced again some restraint seclusion. And this was the first year returning from a year of online schooling. And the fact that the school did not report to us in time, and the district did not have their policies updated, and additionally, there was no record of the staff being trained, that was the type of complaint that I could make to, it was ODE at the time, but the Department of Education and Workforce now, and the Office of Exceptional Children. And that was the only kind of complaint that we could make about the restraint and seclusion, which is really, really disheartening.
We have another caller on the line. Hi, Katrina. Thank you for your call. I think I've got you on the air. Let me try again. Can you hear me, Katrina? Hi, Katrina. Well, my little system's giving me some trouble here.
I can hear you.
Oh, good. Hi, Katrina. Thank you so much. Sorry about that. Tell me what you would like to talk about.
Well, I used to be a special education teacher in Indiana. I left the profession very disheartened. There was a propensity to have seclusion and restraint as almost a go-to for student misbehavior. I worked really hard with I worked with paraprofessionals that were under like my guidance, and sometimes they would try to do restraint just because the student said a cuss word, and I would constantly have to be telling them that, you know, the level that has to be happening is that they are a threat to themselves or others before we do any sort of that intervention, and that we try to do other interventions first. And then when there would be restraint and seclusion happening, sometimes the adults would have a hard time with their own self-regulation, and they would up the ante. So what we were supposed to do is, as soon as that student can be calm, even for a second, you're supposed to, you know, remove your hands and try to settle it down. But they would, you know, no, you need to say sorry to me before we stop this. You've got to stop yelling at me. So sometimes that happens. I think it's a combination of not really getting the training for that self-regulation when you're in that moment. Yeah. The training that we received just mostly focused on how to do the maneuvers, like what to physically do.
Well, thank you, Katrina. I'm going to stop you there because I do want to hear about training here in Ohio. We really appreciate your call and your sharing those experiences, Katrina. Kristen, what kind of training do school employees get to work with children with disabilities and to use these restraint and seclusion practices?
Each school really decides for itself what kind of training they're going to provide to staff. There is a requirement in our restraint and seclusion rule that professional development is provided to staff on an annual basis. And then obviously for new staff that come in. But I think what type of training they get is dependent upon what the school board decides would be the appropriate curriculum. But I do agree with Katrina. I think the typical training that school staff receive is really focused on how to implement the technique of a restraint in a safe fashion, but does not really provide staff the training Katrina was talking about. And that is, how do they manage their own emotions during a restraint process? Because I've seen that repeatedly over and over, where the restraint just results in an increase in the child's behavior, and the adults also getting very upset by the process, and have seen both students and staff get injured during restraint. So that's a very important thing, and Katrina raises a very good point.
Ryan, how has all this affected your son?
It's very much negatively affected him. His attitude towards school is pretty negative. We've reached a point now where things have gotten so bad with the district where have asked multiple times for emergency out of district placement due to his safety concerns, because the injuries are still occurring on a regular basis, and little to nothing's being done to mitigate those. And even provided the documentation from his psychiatrist saying he needs to be put into a specialized school. But we got immense amount of pushback in doing so. And that's really when the relationship with the school district deteriorated heavily.
Mary Kate, what about your son? How has all this affected him?
I am a huge proponent for public education. And we have had to unenroll my son from our public district. He is in high school now, using an online option. So he's not getting the full high school experience that I dreamed of, that his older brother had, and that his peers are having. And it's not fair. And I do recognize that some of the behaviors were dangerous, but it was only after some escalation where there was a power struggle in place. And if the adult could have dropped their end of the metaphorical rope, and asked, okay, is this that big of a deal, or is this a power struggle? I don't think that the situations would have escalated to where they were.
Kristen, the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights was gutted as part of the administration's cost-cutting efforts. Is that affecting the cases that parents have filed regarding their concerns over the use of restraint and seclusion rooms? Are the cases being transferred to the Department of Justice instead?
It's absolutely affecting the speed at which the Office for Civil Rights can investigate complaints filed by families. Before 7 of the 12 regional OCR offices were shut down, there was already a backlog of investigation, and it took a long time for the Office for Civil Rights to make a determination. We have a pending complaint with the department that's been pending for over 2 years, and that was prior to the gutting of the office. So yes, I'm concerned that that it's going to take a very long period of time for these things to be resolved, which is obviously not good for the students who are experiencing the discrimination. As far as I know, pending complaints are just being transferred to one of the still open regional offices of OCR. The other concern that I have really is that the Office for Civil Rights provided a lot of guidance to school districts on how to avoid the use of these techniques and how to implement instead a positive behavioral intervention and support process in the school setting, which focuses on, you know, positive ways to modify student behavior. So that kind of oversight and guidance is certainly going to be less now that many of those offices are closed.
Well, I've been talking with Disability Rights Ohio senior attorney Kristen Hildebrandt and two parents whose children have experienced these practices of restraint and seclusion rooms, Mary Kate Pembroke and Ryan Dunkel. Thank you all so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.